divisive, to say the least.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 5th, 2018.
Oh, I know.
First items on the agenda, we're going to have do the duties of the organizational meeting, and we'll start out with an introduction of committee members. I'll ask you to introduce yourself, starting with Representative Post.
Oh, wow, okay.
You got 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Now let's get the show on the road.
I'm Bill Post from House District 25.
Okay. Chris Gorsuch, House District 49.
Sherry Springer, House District 17 from Sile.
Karin Power, House District 41, Milwaukee Oak Grove, Southeast Portland.
Andy Olson, Albany.
And I'm Jeff Barker, House District 28, which is Beaverton and Aloha.
Jennifer Williams, and do you want to do Whitney
first?
Yeah,
please.
Okay.
Whitney Perez, Judiciary Committee Counsel, and we have two committee assistants, Christy Arrington and Jess Daly.
Woo-woo.
Jennifer Williamson, House District 36, the west side of Portland. Except for what
Except
Mitch
for
has.
My district. I'm Mitch Green Lake, House District 33. That's a big chunk of northwest Portland all the way out to Bethany in Washington County.
Dwayne Stark, House District 4, which is the most beautiful part of our state, including Eagle Point, Central Point, Rogue River, Gold Hill. Good times. Come on down.
It's a pointy district.
Tana Sanchez, House District 43, North and Northeast Portland, the soul.
Rich Vile, House District 26, which runs from South Hillsborough down through Shoals, Sherwood, and Wilsonville to the Willamette River.
How many ones arrested in your district?
Well done. Well done.
Let, and no doubt well reserved or well deserved, I suspect.
I'm sure.
Okay, thank you, committee. And then the next item on the agenda is the adoption of committee rules. You have a copy of the rules in front of you. If anybody has any questions, we'd be glad to answer them.
Ready for a motion?
I'm ready for a motion.
Chair Barker, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 5th, 2018.
Representative Williamson moves to adopt the proposed rules, committee rules dated February 5th, 2018. Is there any discussion?
Is it safe to assume they're not much different than the ones we operated in?
Correct. They are in front of you.
Are there any changes?
Seeing no further discussion, clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
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 Representative Power?
Yes.
Representative Sanchez?
Yes.
Representative Springer?
Yes.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Representative Vile?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Yes.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion passes and the rules are adopted. Next, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4056. And call Representative Olson.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. The first bill for us today is House Bill 4056 and was brought to us by Vice Chair Olson. House Bill 4056 designates 10% of forfeiture proceeds for a scholarship program for family members of certain public safety officers, and it also allows disbursement of certain forfeiture proceeds for support of all specialty courts. There is a -1 amendment on OLIS. The -1 amendment modifies eligibility requirements for the scholarship to include only children of the qualifying public safety officers and make some technical amendments. That's everything.
Hey, thank you. Representative Olson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. And it is truly an honor and a privilege to be moving forward with you on this bill, especially with my colleague over here. Yes, he's a Democrat and everything, but no, I can live with that.
Love you, man.
Yeah, hey. Whoa. Not here. Okay, come on. Okay.
Wow. That's
anyways,
awesome.
Representative Witt and I won't go into great detail about how we were able to get together with a meeting because I don't want to steal his thunder. But there's two programs out there right now that I want to talk to you about that involve the fallen public safety officers' children and how that all plays out. Currently, of these two programs that are administered, there is one that is administered by Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for the Public Safety Memorial Fund. And this program provides available memorial funds benefits that include a lump sum payment of $25,000. And that would be involving health, dental reimbursement, and potentially some issues involving for the eligibility of a spouse or designee for 5 years or until remarriage for children dependents until age 18 or 23 if there's a full-time student involved. And all additionally, then 12 months of mortgage payments and scholarship considerations. The other program is administered by HEC, the Health Educational Coordinating, or correction, Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Sorry, Representative G, I was thinking health care right there for you. That's the deceased or disabled public safety officer grant. That fund runs out quickly, and it has already run out since we closed last year with our session. So when we met, we heard testimony from three different survivors, their wives, where they had lost their husbands. And they're all here today, and I'd like to have them all come up after we get done here and share a little bit of their story for you. We didn't know how to fund this, to be truthful with you, because there was an understanding that the state would provide higher education support financially to the families that lost their husbands or a spouse later on in life. That's not there. That happens to be not there. In 2005, and that's what I kind of want to share with you a little bit, it's kind of interesting because that was my rookie season here. And we went from January 1st, if you remember, and closed the third day of August. My introduction to what the legislature was, it was great. Missed most of the summer. But, well, you know, I got tasked, you know, Mr. Chair, at that time, Wayne Krieger was our chair of the committee, and he asked me to take a look at and rewrite the criminal and civil asset forfeiture laws. So I spent the entire session working on that. I had an extreme amount of help. Senator Brzezinski was huge in helping me craft where we were going with this. Dave Fedanke, who was with the ACLU, was deeply involved. We had members from Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association that were involved. I mean, we just really had a huge group and to make this thing work. Well, one of the things that I wanted to kind of target was developing some direction of where a certain percentage of proceeds could go once the forfeiture came in for the law enforcement agency. So what we did was we actually developed a percentage scheme. So 20% would go to your drug courts. And we're fixing that a little bit from what the director from the Criminal Justice Commission, Michael Schmidt, was interested in having us do. He may address that today. I don't know if he will. He's here. 10% goes to relief nurseries. And the idea behind that, you know, I just popped my head in and listened to a big talk that at that time it was Chief Judge Dave Brewer of the Court of Appeals, who, you know, just retired here a few months back. But he was sharing about the importance of relief nurseries. So immediately I thought, well, let's plug 10% for relief nurseries off of this. We stayed true to what the statute currently was, which was 5% going into the DEQ drug cleanup, because there's a lot of chemicals out there, especially what we dealt with as it came to methamphetamine labs, precursor chemicals, those kind of things. And then 2.5% went to the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Council. So that was it. During our conversation, though, going back a few months back with Representative Witt and the survivors, I came to realize that this might not be a bad avenue for us, where the legislature doesn't have to try to appropriate funds to fill these two programs, but to clearly write a bill that would help be there for higher education for the kids. And therefore, that's where you get with this thing right now. 10% of it is going to be added through this bill toward the proceeds of civil asset forfeitures from law enforcement once they receive those funds. That, I think, is the nutshell version. It's fairly simple. There are some tweaks we still need to do. The dash ones are the start of some of the little tweaks that we need to do. I think Jock Mills is going to share just a little bit too as well from OSU's perspective for the higher education side, and I'm going to stop right there. But the idea is, how did we get here? And I'm going to leave that with you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, if you will, members of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt, House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon in support of House Bill 4056. As you've heard from Representative Olson, we've discussed a little bit of how we got here. I might back it up just a few steps even before Rep. Olson and I became involved. Not surprisingly, and not unlike the way in which many of us who offer legislation, this is a response to some complaints from initially that I received in our office from a couple of constituents, one of whom, Ms. Jeffries, who I think you will be hearing from shortly. Two widows came forward and said that they were having problems with a scholarship fund that our state provides for officers or family members of officers who've been killed or seriously injured in the line of duty. And to boil it down, bottom line, it was difficult getting the money. It was difficult getting the money, period. It was also difficult because the way the system tended to work, it was a retroactive type reimbursement, almost, if you will, for the families that were able to get the money. Mind you, if you're a family member who's lost at least one significant breadwinner in the family, and you're a family member trying to go on for advanced education, the question then becomes, how do I survive while I'm getting through school, period? You know, I may be very grateful at the back end to be able to get some money once I've completed school, but it's literally a survival mode going through college to begin with. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anything about this fund, and I've learned in the years that I've been here at the legislature, one of the worst things you can do is come up with an idea and say, well, I'm going to go tap somebody else's funds. And so that's when I called Rep. Olson, and I said, you know, Andy, do you know anything about this scholarship fund? And I'm getting complaints. I don't know where to turn to. I'm sure there may be some good reasons why people are experiencing problems getting the money, problems that I'm not aware of. And I didn't want to go and come up with a half-cocked idea and have the thing, frankly, backfire or create problems for somebody else. So Rep. Olson and I talked, our staffs talked. Andy actually talked with some of the principals involved. He and I talked some more. We decided that it would be helpful, useful for us to call a meeting with some of the family members, with police agencies at all levels, local, county, state, to get folks involved with the scholarship group, all of us to meet together. Because I didn't want us cooking up a good idea that was going to become a problem for somebody else. I think the long and short after our first meeting was the fact that everybody was in agreement that it needed to be fixed. And to Rep. Olson's credit, he came up with, I think, the magic avenue to be able to fund this without doing any financial harm to anyone else or anyone else's fund. And to a person, I have not heard anything, but that is the most appropriate use of the forfeiture funds. And with that, I thank the committee, Mr. Chairman, very much for hearing us, for hearing the bill. I thank Rep. Olson for his guidance and leadership on this issue. And I would ask for your positive action on the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions, committee?
I do, Mr. Chair and committee members, just kind of close here a little bit, and there might be additional questions down the road. But the college savings plan, that was actually Oregon 529. That was a great idea, and that was actually from Tobias Reed when I was talking to him about this and sharing exactly where we were wanting to go. He automatically jumped right in, and he says this would work really well. And then when we sat down, we had the conversation with the folks from HEC, especially with Kyle Thomas. He's in the Higher Education Committee right now, but he got it too. And Lindsay Hale from DPSST was really helpful with this as well. So, I mean, there's been a lot of people that have been involved in trying to help get this thing squared away. I believe Kevin Campbell's here with the Chiefs and the Sheriff's Association. He's going to share a little bit as well. But I'd love to have you listen to the three survivors, these ladies that have been just, I'll tell you, they're courageous. And I mean, I appreciate them greatly. So.
Thank you. So I don't have those three people on my Senate sheet, but if they would come forward, they could come forward now and we'll. We have Christy Kilcullen, Vicki Jeffries-Bittel, and Corey Gross. So please, Christy, if you would go ahead. And just identify yourself for the record by stating your name as you speak.
If you don't mind, I'm going to go first.
Okay.
Vicki Jeffries.
I don't mind. Okay.
Thank you so much for considering this very important issue that affects public safety, families, and special thanks to Representatives Olson and Witt for being so receptive to our pleas for assistance. You cannot know how grateful we are to have champions of public safety personnel in the legislature. My name is Vicki Jeffries. My husband, Thomas Jeffries, was killed in the line of duty in 1997 after pursuing a suspect who had shot a 7-year-old boy. At the time, I was 7.5 months pregnant with our only child, Nathaniel. Nathaniel is now 20 years old and attending the University of Oregon, which he began in the fall of 2016. As I speak, he should be walking between his literature class and his history class. Members of the Judiciary Committee, our family is in a difficult predicament, both economically and emotionally, and we hope you can help us and all public safety survivors who come after us. Since passage of the Fallen Officers Bill, I and every other survivor and public safety professional that I know believed educational benefits would be available to survivors. For years, I was told that survivors apply for state benefits after federal benefits have been used. All of our education decisions were made on the belief that state benefits would be available. For example, Nathaniel chose a state school because we believed that with the PSOB and state benefits, his education expenses would be largely offset. He wanted to make a prudent decision. A second example, Nathaniel started U of O his freshman year because he believed it would be funded. Otherwise, he would have started at a community college and transitioned to university because at a community college, he would have lower tuition rates because I am a college instructor. In October 2016, I contacted DPSST to start the process to receive benefits. At that time, I was told that there are only undergraduate benefits if the student is ineligible for a public safety officer benefit through the federal government. In turn, I contacted my representative's office for clarification, where it was confirmed that federal funds would be used after state funds. I thought I must have misunderstood and was relieved. However, after Nathaniel's freshman year was completed, I applied for PSOB, beginning a year-by-year application process. I, in turn, contacted DPSST to clarify whether their process was also a year-by-year process or whether I needed to wait for the entire 4 years. During this correspondence, Lindsay Hale clarified to me that the DPSST program has never paid out any educational benefits to survivors. During this time, I also again contacted my representative for clarification on the program. Throughout a number of communications that was occurring at the time, I was told via DPSST to complete a FAFSA and also apply for the deceased officer's grant. I started this process, but immediately encountered enough important questions that I wasn't able to finish it. The questions concerned the type of income and assets that would play a part in determining need. The FAFSA indicated all taxed and untaxed income, assets, etc. would be counted. This meant that my son's Social Security benefit he received, Tom's disability and retirement pension, our home's value, any of savings we've done in the last 20 years and investments, and all of our survivors' benefits would be counted against us. I thought the idea of using survivors' benefits against a survivor for a survivor's benefit couldn't possibly be accurate. So I continued to inquire at DPSST with Lindsay Hale, who helped me gain a clearer understanding of the benefits that are and are not available to survivors. Education is apparently not for those who meet the federal definition of the line of duty death survivor and thus are eligible for PSOB. When I inquired more about the deceased officer's grant, Kristen Vreeland told me the highest expected family contribution, which is a value derived from the FAFSA, they have accepted in the past is $30,000, and this was for a student who was attending a private school, which was a more expensive tuition. A line of duty death survivor's expected family contribution might be more in the realm of $100,000, and thus we could not qualify for this grant either. In addition to the way in which FAFSA was being used to determine financial need, by the time it was clarified that a FAFSA was required, it was too late for Nathaniel to complete one to qualify for benefits for his freshman year. And as a side note, FAFSA is not part of the PSOB program. In summary, since the Fallen Officers Bill was passed, there has been a widespread misunderstanding that there are educational benefits available to survivors. This was our understanding as well, and we made financial and educational decisions specifically based on this understanding. However, over the course of about a year and a half of inquiring, we are finding that our family's loss does not qualify. I hope I can adequately express my sincere gratitude for your consideration of this issue. Tom's death continues to devastate our families, our lives, in ways in which we are continually learning about. The idea that there were educational benefits available to Nathaniel provided some measure of comfort as we forged ahead to the future. Now, with this experience, I am struggling. I find myself asking whether there was some detail of Tom's death that makes him ineligible for education benefits. Whether his actions were not heroic enough or we did not suffer enough. I think it would be easier to understand than if it was due to some detail of the policy or the policy's procedure. I say I'm struggling because my son doesn't know. I haven't had the heart to tell my son that there are no education benefits. And the last time he mentioned it, he was so proud. It was one of the precious few tangible things he had from his dad. And I couldn't take that away from him. I hope you will support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Wow. I guess I will go next. My name is Christy Kilcullen. I think you got me all emotional. I hope I can do this. Chris Kilcullen's my husband. He was shot and killed. April 2011. I've got one. Thank you. And we have two girls. At the time, they were 4 and 11. Now they're 18 and 11. At the time of his death, the first week of his death, I don't know if you've been through death, but it's chaotic and your head is spinning and you're not thinking and it's foggy and people, cops everywhere in our house, in and out, and dignitaries and And I remember the first week I was at home and we had tons of people come and go, and the theme I heard over and over again was, you know, I'm really sorry. People are very gracious. I'm really sorry. There's benefits available. Your girls' college is paid for. And I remember going, oh, thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. It's one less thing I have to worry about. Chris and I have been saving college for our girls since the day I found out I was pregnant. So we have been putting a huge chunk of money, in our words, in our world, a huge chunk of money in their college funds. Well, when people told me that their college would be paid for through these funds, I thought, oh, thank you, Lord, and I stopped contributing. Well, in April, that's going to be 7 years that I haven't been contributing to their college fund. So fast forward to about a year ago. Oh, thank you so much. A year ago or so, when I started inquiring, like Vicki, about, okay, so the forms, the, you know, what do I do? What do I, and that's through when we found out, well, there are no funds. There, it says it, but there's not. None of us qualify. There's no money. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I stopped saving for 7 years for my girls. And it's been a heart punch, and I know we've been very well supported by our community, so I don't want to come before you looking like we're not grateful. I just want you to know from our side, we were told by several different people, local law enforcement agencies, the FBI, cops, all different agencies, that our girls' college would be paid for. And that, like I said, it was just, and Vicki said, it's just one less thing you have to worry about when you're now a single mom of two children, as you can imagine. So I just ask for you to have an open mind and kind of place yourself where we are. We now have children that we have to try to figure out what we're going to do as far as education goes. And I really want to offer my sincere gratitude to you and Representative Witt, Kevin Campbell, and all those behind the scenes that brought us here, because when we got here, we didn't know who to call, who to talk to. And so you guys really are saviors, and I want to thank you a million times over. Thank you, committee.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Please.
My name is Corey Gussie, and my husband, Deputy William Bowman, was killed in the line of duty back in September of 2000. He went off to Camp Ryalea to train with the Special Weapons and Tactics, and through friendly fire, he was struck down that day. I was on maternity leave. Gracie was 2 months old, and Lauren was 2 years old. And from that day forward, I have had an amazing relationship with people who are gracious and kind. And they only had the best of intentions when they told you what they know you needed to hear. Unfortunately, now, as the girls are of college age, what we were promised does not exist. And it's tragic and sad. And I would be gracious for all of you to consider making the changes to such an organization, or I'm sorry, such a house bill for us. And these young ladies have told you quite a bit of information in the past. What I would like to add is that, as a way of giving forward, I am part of a foundation that takes care of line of duty death for any agency in the state of Oregon. We help with it. And so, as a result, I do get to see and meet new survivors. And they are, in fact, hearing these kind of well-intentioned comments as they are trying to put their lives back together. And I would be gracious to be able to tell them that that is in fact true, and that's one less thing off the table. I appreciate your time, and I thank you for your consideration.
Any questions from the committee? I've been here for a while in the legislature, and I worked on these bills. And if you had come to me and asked me, is the college paid for, I would have told you yes, because that was my understanding. And I spoke with John Minnis when he was the director over at DPSST, and he said there had been, I think it was firefighter deaths, and he said, I've got to get some more money in that fund to help pay for that, and we're going to work on it. And then I never had a follow-up on that, but it was new to me when Representative Olson talked to me about this, that this was where we were. I didn't know that. And
can I add to that? I can't tell you how many times officers have come up to me. How are you guys doing? The girls are probably ready for college. At least their college is paid for. And then I get to say, no, it's not. And the look on their face, because we're kind of their, I can't think of a better word, but guinea pigs. Like, God forbid they go through this. We are the faces of their spouses and, you know, the nurturers of their children. And I say, no, you know, but they're like, but everyone says, you know, they're promised it. The departments, they're promised. If, you know, something happens to you, your kids' college will be paid for. And it's not. And so we're kind of the first line of, you know, bringing this forward to say, there's no money, there's no agency, there's no program, there, nothing. And I can't tell you how many times officers have just looked at me like deer in the headlight. So it, we're all under the understanding of that our kids will be taken care of. And unfortunately, that's not accurate.
Well, thank you again for your, once again, for your testimony coming down here. Vicki, I know it's tough to do this every time and so many times, and we will work on this. Because, again, like I say, I was under the same impression you were, and I'm retired from that line of work. So,
thank you, members.
So, Mr. Chair, you can see how strong they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's...
Thank you.
Okay, thank you again. Call Carl Koenig and Kevin Campbell, please.
Hi, good afternoon.
Remember to identify yourself for the record.
Carl Koenig, Legislative Director, Oregon State Firefighters Council. Good afternoon. Just as a small community note, Officer Bill Bowman and I went to paramedic school together. We also flew in Life Flight together. So this might be hard. So I know this. And the expectation, I'm a 28-year firefighter paramedic here in Oregon, Clackamas County. The bill answers the call, just as every firefighter, police officer, parole, probation, prison worker, anybody in public safety in the state of Oregon, the expectation is clearly there. We meet that every single day. This bill dedicates 10% of civil forfeitures, a great start, to the children of secondary or post-secondary education as a result of dying or being permanently disabled in the line of duty as a public safety officer in Oregon. That's really all I have to say. It looks like we have a pretty clear obligation. I know, sitting on the fireside with four public safety officers on this committee, you guys are carrying the heavy weight on the civil forfeiture side. We'll just take all the good press, right? Try to make a light moment out of that quickly. I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today in favor of this important matter of educational security for our children of the Oregon public safety officers killed in the line of duty. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm both the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and then I get the privilege of representing both the chiefs and the sheriffs here in the Oregon legislature. I'd like to begin by thanking Representative Olson and Witt, and many of you on the committee who have signed on the bill, had an opportunity. And I want to thank this committee, because of all the committees in the legislature, you understand and work hard to understand the issues that have been brought to you today, and you've listened to some pretty powerful and in some ways painful testimonies today as well. I think this bill, in simple terms, and I submitted my testimony in its brief, is that it makes something right that is not currently right. And I don't think there was any ill intention, but I think we've just ended up in a position where people who have already suffered a significant, incredible, incalculable sacrifice are further burdened by a system that is not easy to navigate. It's complex, confusing, and on top of that, to go through the process of expecting certain things to be disappointed again is really hard. And so I appreciate this committee's, I know your commitment, to make this right. You know, after serving now the police chiefs for 23 years, this is the hardest type of bill to testify on. Because I have lost friends over the years that I worked alongside in the line of duty. And when I think of Vicki and Christy and Corey today, I think of the fact that they're really heroes. They're survivors, but they're also heroes, and I am so proud of them for bringing today this need forward and to be in front of all of you to say some painful things for everybody else that will come behind them and have to stand in their shoes someday, hopefully very few. I did want to mention briefly that means testing is appropriate in a lot of programs. It is not an appropriate test in for this purpose. These are people that should not have any test required of them in order for their children to access these educational benefits. And so with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am very thankful for the time you've given today, for your attention to this, and I'm hopeful that we can make this correction. I think it's the right thing to do, and I really appreciate your efforts. So with that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you. Kimberly McCullough.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I want to say at the very outset that I think that the this bill should pass. This is a huge problem. I think the state owes these families and survivors funding that's been promised to them. And so I want to be really clear about that. I'm not here to throw any monkey wrenches in the system. But I do want to just raise one concern, and I think it's addressable. And it may be that I'm not understanding the bigger picture of whether or not it's addressable easily, because sometimes the budget process and how funding happens is a little bit like smoke and mirrors to me. My hope is that you will at least consider trying to find a different stable source of funds for this, and if that's possible, that you make that change. And the reason is simply because the issue of asset forfeiture is a really huge kind of hot topic right now. It's a hot topic not only among progressives and people on the left side of the aisle, but also libertarians and a lot of folks that identify as conservative. And one of the main issues that's brought up in those discussions is how the funds are allocated, and the public perception that allocating law enforcement proceeds that are seized by law enforcement to law enforcement creates the incorrect incentive. And I'm not here to impugn the motives of any agency or individual officer. It's more about the appearance of justice and fairness. And I think the appearance of justice is just as important as how it's actually playing out. And so I'm only concerned about that in regards to the source of funds. But absolutely, this fund should be funded. It should be fully funded. And it should be a consistent source of funds, or a reliable source of funds. So, ultimately, if you decide that that's through the asset forfeiture funding system, that's up to you. I have some concerns about the optics of that and how the public perceives it.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of asset forfeiture and how it functions, in this state, you have to have gone through due process, correct? I know that in some places you do not.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I should say, Representative Olson did work with ACLU of Oregon very, very extensively on reforming our asset forfeiture laws, which is why I haven't been coming to this body every year asking for changes. Whereas if you look at other states, there's a lot of need for reform. So I think that we have done a huge amount of work to reform asset forfeiture overall. And so if that alleviates your concerns, ultimately it's up to you. And I should have said this before. I want to apologize to Representative Witt, because I didn't actually reach out to him. And I reached out to Olson because I knew it was your bill, and I didn't realize that it was Representative Witt. So I feel a little bad that I didn't contact him directly. But I just want to say that on the record as well.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Kimberly, you said that you support this bill or this concept, but it specifically talks about the asset forfeiture funds. Mm-hmm. Are you going to still support it if it is asset forfeiture funds
that go into this account?
I would be able to vigorously support it if it had a different source of funds. I think with this source of funds, I have some concerns, but I still think that the bill should pass. So it's up to you if you're not concerned about this how the public is going to perceive it, then I hope that there is no fallout. And certainly I think it's a very good cause, and so maybe there will be no concern at all. But those were things that when we took a look at it, that was immediately where our thoughts went, because that is the conversation around asset forfeiture right now, is where do the funds go, and is that creating incorrect incentives or the appearance of incorrect incentives?
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. Just a statement to that a little bit. Certainly there is a due process here. Mm-hmm. And if law enforcement, if it is found law enforcement has seized funds, mm-hmm, in violation of some constitutional right, violation of any law, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. It is going to happen if they are found to be in compliance, mm-hmm, of laws in the Constitution and any other area of law that needs to be followed. I find it interesting that we're talking about perception, mm-hmm, what might be perception, when we can clearly articulate in this room today there is already an inaccurate perception, mm-hmm, which is the children of cops that are killed or firefighters have access, mm-hmm, to education, and they clearly don't. Right. So I think I would encourage us all to focus a little less on what could be perception and focus more on what is reality.
Thank you, Representative.
Can I just,
sure,
jump in, Mr. Chair? Thank you. A lot of people don't understand and remember that there was a ballot measure back in 2000, 2001. It was called Ballot Measure 3. It actually, there was a lot of misinformation, but it actually turned out okay, you know, now years down the road. But the idea was to actually shut down what the current laws were as it applied toward the civil asset forfeiture. So that's why a few years later we came in to work with House Bill 3457 for that entire session. And in it, what you brought up, Kimberly, is good, great points. We were concerned about perception, obviously, but how we would spend those dollars. Where would be some safeguards for law enforcement to use those dollars, not willy-nilly be able to buy this or that or what. There are specific guidelines on what they can buy. That's where also the percentages entered into it as well, mm-hmm, because we felt that was a good use of what the proceeds were going to be on a lot of things. As we move forward with this, law enforcement, the chiefs, the sheriffs, state police, fire organizations, they have been excited about, mm-hmm, where we're wanting to go with this bill. But that kind of explains maybe a little bit and catches you up to where we're at and your concerns.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, yeah, for bringing those points forward. They are important, and
yeah,
did hear you. Jack Mills and Michael Savaggio, please.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask Vice Chair a question?
Yes.
How much money are we talking about roughly?
I think we're roughly in the neighborhood for a biennium, about $250,000. It's a growing account. Had that conversation with Tobias Reed. He thought that's the best avenue to go with this. So.
Can I ask a follow-up question? What's the variance in the funding stream year over year? Like, how stable is the fund? Do we have any idea?
I really don't know.
Okay, that's fine. I can ask the treasurer. Yeah.
Thank you.
But that's that honestly is a great question, because that's something that could surface. That's right.
But Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Part of the answer to that is hopefully much more stable than the need, given, mm-hmm, our hope that this
we
is not something.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess my concern is just that it's a stable funding source, and we know that we're, mm-hmm, we're dealing with a stable funding source and not something that swings, yeah, greatly. And I have no idea.
Stock market. Let's just drop 1,000 points. Please, anybody that needs to speak, or as you speak, please identify yourself for the record, and you can go in any order you'd like.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I'm Jock Mills. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs, the Government Relations for Oregon State University. But I'm here for all seven universities. We split areas up in terms of working with each other, and so I'm here speaking on behalf of all of your public universities in Oregon. And we saw this bill. I had a nice conversation with Representative Olson. We're quite supportive of the bill, and I'm simply here to assure you we'll do everything we can. There's some administrative work that we'll assure you that gets taken place, and that if this bill passes, the benefits you're seeking are passed through to the rightful recipients. I'm here with Kyle as well, and I'll let Kyle talk to a number of issues I think you face in maybe wanting to clarify in the bill to get the maximum effect. One of the things that we are really supportive of is, in essence, this bill ensures that funds that might otherwise be spent through the Opportunity Grant, Oregon Opportunity Grant, use these funds. That's great, because what you're doing then is freeing up funds that would be otherwise in the Opportunity Grant, mm-hmm. enabling them to go to other students of need. So that's a really good thing, side benefit associated with this bill. And with that, I think, continuum issues here are, we really want to make sure that these aren't one-time only funds, so that if a student makes use of these funds, say at community college, it's a once and done. We're all interested, and you've heard this before, that going through to community colleges and not being able to use these funds for the next 2 years at a four-year institution isn't what you want. It's certainly not what we want, and so we want to make sure this bill does that. And with that, I'm done with my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I did submit written testimony. I'm not going to read off of that. I'm just going to address a couple of the things I've heard in conversation. Hopefully, I can find a little bit of clarity from the agency perspective. First, I want to be sure that the committee understands that there are two separate grant programs that do address the dependents of fallen officers. One is the Deceased and Disabled Public Safety Officer program that the HEC administers, and the other is a grant program that's administered from DPSST. And I understand there's been some anecdotal discussion about the difficulty in accessing the DPSST funds. That is not the purview of this legislation. The legislation is strictly about the DDPSO that the HEC administers. That fund has paid out approximately $400,000 in grants to dependents of fallen officers over the course of the last 9 years. In the current year, it's serving approximately 8 students, and we awarded $75,500, a low award of $5,600 and a high award of $11,500 in this particular year. So as to the sufficiency of the 10% set aside of the asset forfeiture account, if it is relatively stable, and I don't know that it is, but if it is around $250,000, given the amount of money we award on a year-to-year basis, it is highly likely to be sufficient for the awarding of this grant. It's possible, though, because of changes that are made in this bill, the amount of money we do award via the grant will go up, and the reason is that this bill eliminates the means test. It was a rather awkward means test in the original statute, requiring that the fallen officer have an income that was less than their peers in a similarly situated rank. That's deleted over the course of the bill. So now anyone who qualifies based on the other criteria in the legislation would be eligible for this grant. So we would anticipate that it's possible that the amounts that we award increase, but it is unlikely that it would be to the point where the funding mechanism is insufficient, especially since the funds are continuously appropriated. So it's potentially only an issue in the first couple of years as the account builds up. And I do want to make very clear that this, as it's currently constructed, the grant only provides for funding up to a student's tuition and fees. So that was the case in the prior version of this program. It's the case in the current legislation. So that means there are some ancillary costs. The federal government uses the term cost of attendance, which is tuition and mandatory fees, but it's also housing, books, and transportation. Those costs are not covered based on the current statute. And finally, as Jock has alluded to, there is one ambiguity in the legislation that I've highlighted in my written testimony. and that is it's unclear in the bill right now if a student goes into, a community college and gets a certificate or an associate's degree, whether or not they maintain their eligibility for the grant through such a time that they complete their bachelor's degree. So we're happy to offer a modification to the language that would clarify that issue so a student maintains that eligibility. Thank you.
Please.
Kyle, do you keep records on the number of students that apply for aid and do not qualify? Do you have any sense of the unmet need?
I would have to, Representative Barker, Representative Williamson, I would have to go back and talk to my financial aid folks. I don't know.
If you could do that, that would be
sure.
Great. Thank you.
May I just clarify? Thank you. When you talk about unmet need, are you talking about unmet need for that fee, tuition and fees only, not for the entire cost of education?
What I'm talking about is any student who comes to apply for the grant who right now is means tested out. So do we know what the universe of students who are not being served, who will be served? Do we keep any records of people who apply and then are means tested out of the program?
So I think it would be useful to also be sure that the characterization of this program is understood, that if a student is means tested in other words, qualifies for the Pell Grant and, say, the Opportunity Grant, and there's still a differential between that and what the tuition and fee bill is, that's what this bill takes care of. So it's kind of a last dollar in. We make sure we're covering it all. So if you have a student who, because of income, is qualified for Pell and Opportunity Grant, this bill has those funds used first and then fills in the difference. If you have a student who doesn't qualify because of income for either the Opportunity Grant or Pell, this bill ensures that that's all taken care of.
And those are the students, I guess, I'm looking for to see what the universe of cost on the bill is, so we know whether or not the fund is sufficient. Because right now we don't know necessarily that what's in the asset forfeiture account with this percentage is sufficient to meet the need.
What you do know is it's relying on those other funds first before coming to the fund, and that should be of some comfort to you.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio. I'm here representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. We represent line officers and sheriff's deputies around the state. I'm going to keep my comments relatively brief. I think that a lot of it's been gone over already, and this is a special time for me because I am both humbled and very proud to be representing the families that I represent today. I'm not going to rehash the testimony that's already gone before me, but I will say that we don't have a single member of our organization that is not very cognizant of the fact that they are one bad incident away from ending their watch. And the fact that the state is ready, willing, and intentioned to make good on these promises means the world, not only for those families that are already undergoing these challenges, but also for all of the officers that are watching right now. So I really appreciate the committee's work on this topic. I also want to take a few moments to thank Ms. McCullough with the ACLU for having the discussion that she had. It was certainly educational for me. We've been talking before this hearing, and I think that the discussion today has been made stronger by having those issues brought to the fore and having those aired out. This bill has our complete support, and I hope that this committee can turn around some positive action on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Greenlee.
I understand there's a conceptual question of whether this is mean tested or not means tested. And I would certainly imagine it should not be mean tested, but if it is, what's all the complications going on about assets and income levels from pastime? It sounds very arcane and very complicated. Can you sort of help me understand why it's not simpler? I mean, you apply for a Pell, you have an answer.
Representative Barker, Representative Greenlee, the previous means testing for this program wasn't as complex as traditional means testing is perhaps for other state programs, which relies on the FAFSA, which relies on family income, family assets, the number of dependents that you have, the number of dependents that are in college in a particular family. This was a much more simple means test. It was, did the qualifying officer have an income that was below that of the income of a similarly situated officer with the same rank?
Well, if they're dead, they have a very low income level.
Representative Barker, Representative Greenlick, and this bill does eliminate that component. So where it previously would have served as a disqualifying factor, it will not going forward into the future.
But it still requires the recipients to fill out the federal FAFSA, which stands for the federal, financial aid, whatever. Having just filled one of those out, whether or not it's means tested, that's a very it's a very complicated and rigorous tool that is you need to go through, and that's the way the financial aid system works. So to get financial aid in this state, you fill out the FAFSA. There's a lot of resources out there to help you fill it out, but if you have various sources of income, various sources of savings and other things, the FAFSA is designed to figure those things out when determining your degree of financial need. What this bill does is you may still need to fill out the FAFSA, but it's not material to the decision as to whether or not you qualify for this grant.
This it is a policy question as to whether or not you wish to require those students to fill out the FAFSA. Knowing that they would be eligible for this grant and knowing that it would cover tuition and fees, it cannot be a determining factor that a student has to fill out the FAFSA. Now, the side effect of that is a student who would qualify for federal assistance, such as the Pell Grant, now would not qualify for federal assistance, and it puts a greater burden on the funding source that you've identified here today.
Or, in other words, you'd be turning away Pell Grant money and using this fund to use it instead.
Yeah.
Answer your question?
No, I'm just a little frustrated trying to understand the situation. These are very special cases. This isn't, you're not dealing with 10,000 a year. What are you dealing with? A couple dozen a year, maybe.
Yeah, I, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, neither of us is here to guide you in taking a particular direction. We just want to be sure you know what direction you're going when you make the decisions you make. And that's simply, I think,
what we're trying to do. I always appreciate knowing which direction I'm going. I don't always get there, but.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to something that was said. It might have been by you, sir. So you distinguish between the HEC program, which yes. This deals with, mm-hmm. and the program done by DPSST.
Yes.
Can you clarify, is DPSST, is it just disabled then, officers? And this is for officers that are killed in the line of duty, or how is that divided up?
Representative Barker, Representative Gorsuch, I actually wasn't intending to speak here today, so I didn't do a pretty in-depth research around what the DPSST program is, so I'm going to refrain from comments and see if there's a DPSST official that can answer the question.
I mean, Lindsay's here, but it's for fallen and disabled.
Okay. So as I understand it, maybe to you, Representative Olson, as I understand it, the DPSST program has been the problem in
the
past.
We'll find out in just a minute. I don't know if that's the right word.
Okay. Anybody? I wouldn't say they're a problem. I mean,
The testimony was that DPSST, they were trying to deal with them and weren't getting the answers they needed. So I'm just trying to clarify that.
We'll find out here in just a second.
Okay.
Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Come on up, Lindsay. And Mike Schmidt, if you want to come up too, then be ready.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Hale. I oversee the Professional Standards Division at DPSST, and part of my responsibilities are the honor and the privilege of working with our six-member board on administering the Public Safety Memorial Fund.
So I guess what I'll just do is give you a brief kind of oversight of what that fund is and how we go about administering it. The fund has existed in statute since 1999, and it was established to provide temporary and immediate financial assistance to the families of fallen public safety officers, as well as to the public safety officers who are permanently and totally disabled in the line of duty. I believe it was around 2005 when the expansion of the fund, it was expanded to include the discretionary benefit of providing scholarship considerations to the dependents of or the officers who were disabled, who suffer a line of duty tragedy. The fund itself is statutorily established to be secondary to every other fund that was discussed today. So by law, the Memorial Fund the Memorial Fund Board cannot consider an application for scholarship benefits unless the federal PSOB program has been exhausted and all other available benefits for scholarships have been exhausted, which include the deceased and disabled public safety officer grant, which we've talked about, and it includes the federal financial aid program. So I have been employed by DPSST for 7 years and involved in the administration of the Memorial Fund for in some capacity for that same 7 years. We've not had an application for benefits for scholarships because those funds have not been exhausted, or there has not been a situation where those funds have been exhausted. So again, I don't think it's that the Memorial Fund is broken. I think just the way that it's structured to be secondary to all of these other funds has led to some confusion and some frustration that you're hearing about today.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I'd like to thank Representative Olson, who is a former commissioner of ours and is always well aware and looking for things to assist CJC with and helping us look at the specialty court language in this bill. I came up here not intending to talk today, but because you were asking some questions around stability of the funds and amounts. And I just thought it might be instructive to let you know two things. One, the CJC staffs the Asset Forfeiture Committee. So we write and publish a report every single year. We send it to this body. In that report annually tells you all the amounts that are seized. It also lets you know what the percentages are and where those funds go to. So I don't have those figures in front of me. They're available on our website, and I can certainly look up and see. But my experience as a director of an agency that does receive some of these funds, because we receive 20% of the fund for our specialty courts program, and I'm only familiar as far back as 2013, but it's been a very stable funding source for our agency. I believe around in a biennium, we've received as much as between $600,000 to $900,000 for a biennium of funding, especially courts at 20%. I think this biennium is going to be closer to the $900,000 mark of proceeds. So if this fund is set at 10%, then I'd expect you to receive about half of that amount for the biennium. And we've seen that fund to be very stable over the last several biennium, and it does seem to be going slightly upwards. So I do think that this would be a stable fund, and slightly, that's a ballpark of, I think, what you could expect.
Okay. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought this would help. I'm getting more confused, quite frankly. Maybe I'm the only one on this committee, but I'm getting more confused. You've not had one application for these funds in 7 years.
For the Chair Barker, members of the committee, apologies. For the scholarship benefit, we have not, no. So as Representative Olson mentioned in his testimony, there are a couple of different prongs that exist in the Memorial Fund. The most important prong is that mandatory lump sum benefit that's awarded upon the determination that there is a qualifying death or disability that occurred in Oregon.
Right.
So, and again, it's temporary immediate financial assistance. So what that $25,000 is intended to do is to bridge the gap between when the incident happens to when all of the other benefits kick in, essentially. So you have your federal lump sum benefit that comes from the Department of Justice. You have your life insurance, your SAFE, all of those other things. So that Memorial Fund Board, once they make a determination that there is a qualifying death or disability, they're required within 14 days to get that check out the door. And we have, most recently with the tragedy that occurred in Seaside, we were able to do that in 2 days. So it is a very streamlined system to recognize the immediacy of the need of those funds. The other prongs that exist within the Memorial Fund are what we call discretionary benefits. And here's where you get your kind of your needs test, your means test. The Memorial Fund Board can choose to award benefits to assist with mortgage payments. They can award benefits that assist with health and dental reimbursement. And in certain situations, they can assist with scholarship considerations. So in those situations, they would get an application and they would consider the totality of the case and make a determination whether or not they are able to assist the family. With respect to the scholarship considerations, because the fund is statutorily set up to be secondary to all of the other available funds, we've not gotten to a place where the Memorial Fund was even legally allowed to consider an application, because either the federal benefits haven't been exhausted or the other benefits that are available have not been applied for or exhausted. So it's set up to come in at the very, very end, which is why we've not, at least in my tenure, had an application for scholarship considerations. So if you look at the Memorial Fund statute, it even takes into account, and I believe one of the survivors mentioned, because these other benefits that are available were intended to provide scholarship tuition reimbursement for undergraduate degrees, the Memorial Fund is specifically designed to provide graduate level assistance for scholarships. There is a caveat in there that says if the federal fund is no longer available to assist with undergraduate degrees, that the Memorial Fund could consider the application for undergraduate, but its main purpose is graduate level education. I don't know if that helped you or made it more confusing.
It helped. Okay.
Hey, thank you. Any further questions?
Yeah.
I'm curious, and this sounds like it might be a good question for you, Mike. Where do the balance of the funds currently go? I see certain line items that are allocated to certain funds, but obviously there's a larger share that is not currently allocated specifically for any particular purpose.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Power. So the law enforcement agencies themselves retain the balance of the funds that aren't specifically delineated out by specific percentages to certain fund shares, and they are have certain things that they are allowed to purchase with those funds. So it stays with the seizing agency.
So can you chip in on that? Yeah, so that's a great question. There were six specific areas that law enforcement could use the proceeds for themselves. Mm-hmm. One could be for buy money for when they're going out working narcotics. It could be for purchasing vehicles. It could be purchasing firearms. Trying to remember some of the other things. But they all had to stay within a certain specific framework. If you recall, maybe about 4 or 6 years ago, we added one additional piece to that for the law enforcement agencies to consider contribution or the use of, and that was for CASA. Hmm.
What?
That was CASA. That was a mechanism that we injected into that for them. But you got to also remember what we did, you know, Representative Williamson, with 3194 on 10% potentially for the victims could be used by CASA. So.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4056 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4095.
Members of the committee, thank you so much. House Bill 4095 was a House Judiciary Committee bill this session, and it's here before you today. It extends the existing evidentiary attorney-client privilege found in the Evidence Code, that's Rule 503, and it extends it to communications between a potential client and a lawyer referral service, as well as defining lawyer referral service. There's no amendment to this measure. We have received the paperwork. It has a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact, so if you're prepared to move it today, we can.
Okay, thank you. Call Amber Hollister, Evic McClendon, and Mary Sophia, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Amber Hollister, excuse me, Amber Hollister, General Counsel for the Oregon State Bar, here to speak with you today about House Bill 4095. With me today is Eric McClendon. He is the manager of the Oregon State Bar's referral and information system. So he's here really as an expert on their on the program in case you have any specific questions.
Hi there. Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Mary Sophia. I am the legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Would you like to go first?
Sure, I'd be happy to. We didn't coordinate, so so first I just wanted to ask a quick clarifying question before I move on into my testimony, and it had to do with the reference to this bill having a minimal fiscal. We weren't aware of the fact that it would be assigned a fiscal, and so I just wanted to clarify that piece.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Amber, there is a minimal expenditure impact on the measure. It does not have a referral to Ways and Means. It just says there shall be, there probably will be some small impact on the affected agencies, which listed here are the Department of Justice and the Oregon Judicial Department.
Thank you. All right, Chair Barker, members of the committee, today I'm here to speak with you about a very gentle expansion of the attorney-client privilege, which will allow additional protection to individuals who utilize lawyer referral services to find a lawyer. These are individuals who may not already know a lawyer who can provide them with assistance, and so they need to reach out and share factual information so that they can be matched with the appropriate lawyer. So at its heart, this bill, House Bill 4095, is a consumer protection measure. It's designed to protect ordinary Oregonians who really want to do the right thing in solving their legal problems. And I wanted to give Eric here a chance to just give a brief overview of the Oregon State Bar's lawyer referral service so you can understand why you're seeing me here today talking about this issue.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Eric McClendon, and I am the manager of the Oregon State Bar's Referral and Information Services Department. Excuse me. The Referral and Information Services Department has a variety of programs to assist the public in finding an attorney. The largest is our lawyer referral service. In 2016, we received over 74,000 phone calls and 4,000 emails from Oregonians who found themselves in need of legal advice. And we made almost 48,000 referrals to Oregon attorneys. Mm-hmm. We also provide callers information about other Oregon State Bar government and community service programs that can assist them. I'm here to testify in support of the bill and answer any questions you might have specifically about the lawyer referral service. Now I'll turn it over to Ms. Hollister to outline the consumer protection provisions of the bill.
Thank you, Eric. So obviously the bar is a proponent of this measure because we have a first row seat to the dilemma faced by consumers who want to be matched with an appropriate lawyer but are concerned about disclosing information necessary to make the match. Oftentimes information shared with our LRS or similar services is very sensitive. You can imagine people are often in crisis when they're looking for a lawyer. They have a tendency to overshare, and we don't really have a way to control that. So we want to make sure that we get sufficient information to make the match and acknowledge that, that stream of information coming to us may include some very sensitive information. So what this bill does is it clarifies that the attorney-client privilege extends to communications between that Oregon consumer and the lawyer referral service, and that it also would apply to information shared between the lawyer referral service and the lawyer to let them know that the referral is coming. So it really is on both sides of the equation. The purpose of expanding the privilege is to really, it's similar to the purpose of the privilege generally, which is to allow open, candid communication, which is necessary for the attorney to understand the needs of the client. The privilege still belongs to the client. So in this instance, if I were a client and I called the lawyer referral service, shared sensitive information, I would be in the driver's seat as the client as to whether or not that information is introduced as evidence in court. I would be the owner of the privilege. So this really does give the power to Oregon consumers to better manage their own information. Just one more piece about the policy rationale for this bill. The bar really believes in the attorney-client privilege because it's necessary to build trust with a consumer out of the gate. We think that people do a better job representing their own interests in the justice system when they can get good advice. We're seeing, I think, more and more people seeking to self-represent. We want to make sure that obtaining legal advice is still an option, and it's one that's understood and readily available. So I'm happy to answer any questions about the bill, but that's all I've prepared for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have there been instances where a law enforcement agency or some other party attempted to get information from one of our lawyer referral services?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Vile. So there have been instances nationally where that has occurred. The one that I'm somewhat familiar with occurred in California, where there was a subpoena filed seeking information shared with the lawyer referral service. There's no published decision on how that came out, so I can't report to you what happened. But I think that there is a need to provide another level of confidence to the exchange of information. I think Eric can probably speak to this better than I can, but it's common for consumers who call the lawyer referral service to ask whether or not their information will be kept confidential. There really is a desire to make sure of that, and so we'd like to be able to provide individuals with reassurance.
Briefly, Chair Barker, members of the committee, again, Mary Sophia with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. I'm here to just happily support the passage of this bill. It's common sense, and it's a super small edit, but it does a huge thing. So I come at this from the perspective of obviously a criminal defense lawyer with 6 years of experience, but also during the same time I also practiced family law. The lawyer referral service is a huge a service provided to citizens of Oregon, and so I myself have called the lawyer referral service at one point or another looking for a referral. And so when that information is essentially being shared, it's not just being shared in a criminal context, but also in all sorts of contexts. And so really, confidentiality between a client and a lawyer or a client a lawyer and a potential client is really a core tenet of what we expect when you're seeking advice. And so, again, it makes a lot of sense. I just wanted to come up here and be a voice of support and kind of a lawyer perspective.
And so this is also to be sure. So I look online and find a lawyer online. I mean, there's legal service online. So that's right now it's not necessarily confidential by what I share with them. This would make it confidential. Is that correct?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I think the bar would do its best to assert that the information is covered by the attorney-client privilege, but ultimately that determination would be made on a case-by-case basis by a court. This measure would provide more certainty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, it strikes me that this is not necessarily a huge problem now, but it may be a problem in perception. And I like the idea that we address those folks calling in wondering if their information is confidential. I can tell you that as a civil lawyer, every time somebody called me about a potential case, from the moment they began talking, I assumed that I was speaking to them in confidence and that they still held their power to keep me from divulging what I had heard from them, even if I didn't take them as a client. I think statutorily recognizing that may be a good thing to help consumers understand what they're doing. So I would definitely support the idea.
Thank you. I think it'd be very important. If I'm talking to somebody, I've talked to an attorney, I expect that not to go anywhere else, mm-hmm. even if you don't take the case. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Move to a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 4095 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Williamson will be the carrier. Any
Any further business to come before the committee today? Thank you very much, committee. You stand adjourned.